been a while since I've been up here for you guys. I don't know exactly how to start this because I have to do this introduction. Many of you may know that God decided to transplant Cricket. She's now living in Ringwood with me. And several months ago, she came home from a meeting and she said, "I was asked to speak at the Soberfest fundraiser." And I said, "Well, that's wonderful." And she said, "Well, I told them I'd only do it if you'd introduce me." Now, what I want to tell you is it took me all the way, months, to get to today to understand why she asked me to introduce her. I introduced her nearly 2 years ago at Soberfest. She did not like the fact that I was not a very good host. And but then she wasn't a very good hostie either, so so I think she said if she'd introduce me again, so maybe I'd get a chance to do it, you know, because I've learned in this program you always get to keep doing things until you get them right. And we'll see how this goes later. After I heard her speak at Soberfest, I called her up. We had several conversations, and she asked me to do a favor for her, to write her life story. And I picked myself up off the floor and said, okay. And then as time progressed, and with much prayer and much discussion, she decided to come here to Ringwood, to McHenry, to all over here. And it's been an incredible journey. If you had asked me 2 years ago whether I would be doing this, I would have said you were nuts. I've always wanted to write a book, but this is definitely a God thing. This is not something I ever decided or even dreamed would happen, much less to be able to share an entirely unbelievable spiritual human being and to be able to learn how it is she does what she does. She has gifted me in ways she will never know with spiritual growth. I am a fledgling. I've been doing this for a long time, but I am a fledgling. I have much to learn, and she has much to teach, and I hope you'll really enjoy what her story can impart to you tonight. So I give you Cricket, not from Fort Worth, but from Ringwood, Illinois.
Hi, y'all. I'm Cricket. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to do what we do in Texas, y'all. My sobriety date's October the 19th of 1969, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful to be sober that long. I'm grateful to be alive long enough to be sober that long. And I'm even grateful I live in Ringwood, Illinois. It's an experience. I've had a whole lot. I'm the richest woman any of y'all are ever going to meet. I don't think you're going to meet anybody anywhere that is more blessed than I am. I don't think you're going to meet anybody that has more than I have or been more places than I've been. And all, you know, I was thinking last night, I was listening to a little bit of political stuff. And I don't like political stuff because I'm not allowed to vote. But my friend loves it. And she can really get, it's like watching an evangelist. You know, well, here's this man called John Kerry. And his wife was talking about him, and she was married once before, and then she married this guy, and she said one good thing about it, both of their names were John. So it's easy to keep track of them. And most of the men I was involved with before I got sober were named John. So to let you know, I was never married before I got sober. I've had 12 husbands in sobriety. Two of them were my own. I'm telling y'all, I've had a couple really hard weeks physically, and I get overly tired, and I'm pretty outspoken anyway, and tad bit ornery, and you couple that with being overly tired, and a couple weeks ago, Sue and I didn't think I was going to make it, and when you're facing that, I contemplated how important is all this stuff. What would I change about me? not much. And none of it's very important. You know, it's all going to go away anyway, so none of it's really that important. I will try to share with you where I was to make me get to where I am and where I want to go. I was born to a different type of family. My biological father is a full-blooded Frenchman, and he sired 17 kids. So I can tell you that I may not come from an important father, but I do come from a potent father. My mama's full-blooded Black Irish. And I don't know if any of y'all are familiar with the Black Irish, but they're a very, very superstitious group of people. And they believe that one child in every family is born evil. They're born possessed. And you determine it by the weight at birth. And the least one is the one. And I weighed 2.5 pounds when I was born. I became evil, and I became possessed. And stayed that way till I had 8 years of sobriety, 15 years of sobriety, maybe even longer. But I'm getting better. My mama and daddy evidently didn't get along except on occasion. He was one of the first service workers I ever met. He believed in the spirit of rotation. He believed in planting the seed and moving on, not waiting for the results. He was really, really would have been a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous as far as the service structure goes. But she was real, real fortunate. She married this guy. He was a neat guy. He had a third grade education, and y'all, this is way back in the early 40s. So we made our living following crops across the United States of America. And I have to tell you, it was absolutely amazing. I loved following crops, and to this day, I still love the dirt of the earth. I have a feeling for dirt and soil that most people are never blessed to have. I enjoy it when you dig down enough and it's cool, or you dig down far enough and it's warm. And you look at it, you know, if you plant a potato and the ground cracks, is that potato saying, here I am? And you just dig your fingers in that ground and that's what comes out as a potato because that's what you put there. And it's amazing. I was driving one day about a year or so ago, I guess, and I'd never seen it in my life. Fields of the prettiest yellow and green, and it was so alive. And I looked at Sue and I said, what is that? Soybeans. I'd never seen a soybean. You don't have to go very far to find beauty. You know, you don't have to go to Neiman Marcus. Those places are nice. You don't have to go to a perfume shop to smell good smells. You really don't have to do that. Take a newborn baby or a baby puppy and just hold them and sniff all over. You know, the right end, please. But, you know, there's something that smells so good about things that God created that man could not and did not and still can't and will not. They just can't. Those things that just God can do, there's something so amazingly clean and beautiful and fragrant about that. As we followed the crops, every time the picking season changed, we had to move. And every time we had to move, we had to start a new school. We didn't have to stay, but we had to start. And every time we started a new school, I didn't fit in. I just didn't. And I knew in my heart, I felt like it was because of the outside of Cricket. If all of this were different, if my hair were a different color, if my eyes were a different color, if my skin were a different color, if this was all different, you would allow your children to play with me. If this were different, I would be okay, and I would fit in. But this stayed just the way it was. We didn't have the things in our family because crop fallers just didn't have them back then for proper physical hygiene. So I had horribly ugly hair. It was all matted and gnarled and hung down to my waist, and my skin was awful, and my teeth was awful. I just didn't look on the outside in a manner that made most people approachable. They just didn't want to come near me. And I have to be careful in Alcoholics Anonymous, because even in Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes we look at the outside package and we decide we don't want to associate with that person. We look at the outside package and think, well, I don't, you know, I'm not sure. And that's a judgment call. And unfortunately, sometimes we lose the beauty of something that's just unbelievably good and sincere because we look from here out instead of from here in. And that's kind of the way that I felt was done with me, and it's the way I did with others. As crop followers, we attended church on a regular basis. I like that. I like that because most alcoholics talk about going to church on a regular basis. We went twice a year, every year, regularly. Let me tell you why. We went at Thanksgiving time and we went at Christmas time. Because at Thanksgiving and Christmas, ministers would stand behind a pulpit and they would tell their congregation, y'all should feed those hungry people. You should be kind to those less fortunate than you. And guess who it was? Me and my family. And so twice a year, they would be kind. Two times a year. They'd give us a big wicker basket that had food and meat and maybe that old Christmas ribbon-type candy, maybe Crayolas and coloring books. But to get that, we had to listen to the sermon all the way through. And I remember sitting there, and the man behind the pulpit wore a suit. He was real well-dressed, and he spoke real good. And I remember him saying, anything I pray for in the name of Jesus, I would receive. And I sat there in that congregation, and I thought, anything I pray for in the name of Jesus, I'm going to receive. And I thought about that for a while, and I thought, what do I want more than anything in the world? This is my opportunity, one wish to come true. And I went home, and they assigned crop followers one room and a kitchenette. And all the bath privileges are outside. And I remember going home and looking in the mirror at my face. And I thought, if I could have anything I wanted, we don't have toys. I don't care if we have indoor toilet. But if I could have anything I wanted, I'd want a clear face. A face that when you looked at me and your children looked at me, you wouldn't turn away in disgust. And I found a place on my face that didn't have a zit. And I put my finger on it and I said, in the name of Jesus, when I wake up in the morning, make the rest of my face as clear as this spot is right here. And I really believed that when I woke up, I would have clear skin. As an adult, I understand that you were afraid of us. You were afraid of crop followers. You didn't understand the culture. It wasn't the outside of cricket that frightened you. It was the lifestyle of the crop follower that frightened you, and that was because you didn't understand it. You didn't know what it was. When I woke up in the morning, I ran to the mirror because I knew I'd said, in the name of Jesus, make the rest of my face as clear as this spot is right here. But when I got to the mirror, there was a zit right where I prayed. And see, you know what? That told me Jesus didn't love me. Jesus didn't like me. Now, I'm not going to tell you that that preacher was wrong. I will tell you, I don't think he knew what I heard. He didn't know what message I heard come from his lips. I'm very careful what I tell people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I work with that will happen to them. I don't promise anybody that their marriage will work out. I don't promise them that they'll keep their job, that they'll get an education, that their kids are going to be good kids. I can't make that kind of promise because I don't know. What I will promise them is, if they're willing to turn their will and their life over to the care of God as they understand Him, there will be a solution to every problem, and you can walk through any storm with your head held high. Any storm that and that's the only promise I can guarantee. We wound up in Denver, Colorado, and we finally got a house. Now, it didn't have indoor plumbing, but there was actually two bedrooms and a kitchen. Some amazing things happened in that house. Some things that society looks down upon with some sorrow and some anger. It was a house where I learned that it was safer for me to be outside than it was to be inside. And I was old enough at this time to determine that I needed to find a safe place. I needed to find a place where I could hide away, where nobody else could fit. And some of y'all, I can tell by looking, some of y'all are old enough to remember the old wood stoves. Well, we had an old wood stove. And that's what we heated the Saturday night bath water on. That's what we cooked our meals on. That's what we heated our home with. And also, It was a place that I could crawl behind. And when I crawled behind the old wood stove, I fit just right. And nobody else could get in there. And I was safe. And behind the old wood stove, I tried to pretend the outside of Cricket Away. Because, see, if this were all different, everything would be okay inside. Behind the old wood stove is where I took my first drink of whiskey. I was 12 years of age. Two of my older brothers by this time were professional men. They were career men. They were armed robbers. And they would come. They came and they made a hole behind my stove, y'all. And they hid their guns and money back there. And if I didn't tell Mama, they gave me a present. And I didn't know what it was. They brought it to me. They said, "Now you can't tell." I said, "I won't tell. I'll be anything. I won't tell. I'm getting a prize." And I didn't know what it was, and I still get excited when I get prizes. My heart jumps. And I open the sack, and here's this little, I'm sure it was a pint, and I still didn't know what it was, but my brothers had given it to me. And I opened up that little bottle of whiskey, and I put it up to my mouth. I'm 12 years of age. That whiskey burned my throat. It burned my chest. That whiskey burned all the way down. It burned my fingertips. It burned all the way back up again. And it burned all the way back down again. And I drank it until that bottle was empty. And I went to God with a prayer. And I remember the prayer to this day. "Dear God, sir, my name is Cricket. And I don't believe in you. I don't believe in family. I don't believe in cleanliness. And I don't believe in goodness. But just in case you are, this is my very last prayer to you. Help me to never feel again. And, sir, I don't want any special favors. I don't want to even feel good." I left home at the age of 12, started doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. I lived on the streets of Denver, Colorado, and the state of Colorado interfered. They took me from the streets of Denver, placed me in the reform school in Morrison, Colorado. They said I was incorrigible. I didn't know what that word meant, but I'd been called a lot of things, so it didn't matter. But they were going to punish me for it. And I thought, okay. They took me from the streets of Denver to Morrison, Colorado, to the Girls State Reform School. This is way back yonder, y'all. And they took me into this big brick building, and I thought I had absolutely died and gone to heaven. There was a great big old white bathtub, indoor toilet. You just push this little slipper handle and everything goes away. One person to a bed. Two sheets on a bed, three meals a day. I loved being punished. It was absolutely wonderful. I had experiences I'd never had before. I stayed in the reform school for about a year, and I guess I became corrigible because they released me. I went right back to the streets of Denver, Colorado, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcoholism. Back in the middle 50s, they did not recognize alcoholism, much less teenage alcoholism. When I was approximately 16 years of age, the state of Colorado stepped in one more time. They took me off the streets of Denver and told me that young girls don't live the lifestyle I was living. And I thought, why not? I'm not bothering anybody if they don't bother me. Why? And so what they did is they took me to the Colorado State Insane Asylum in Pueblo, Colorado. And they had to diagnose me. So they diagnosed me as schizophrenic, with paranoid reaction, with psychotic tendencies. I thought, my gosh, that's a lot of stuff. And I'm only 16 and I didn't have to go to school to get it. You know, I'm all of this. In the Colorado State Insane Asylum, I can laugh about it to a point. I knew a fear that I'd never known before nor since. A fear that went from the outside of Cricket all the way inside. And all of my life I had learned how to kill me. I had learned how to kill my soul and my heart to where nothing would hurt me again. My prayer was being answered. In that Colorado State Insane Asylum, to make me not be those things, they gave me 10 milligrams of Valium, 25 milligrams of Librium, and 50 milligrams of Thorazine four times a day. The compulsion to drink was removed. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, they administered electric shock treatments. And this is back in the early to middle 50s. And I remember vividly how they'd lie me on a gurney. And they would hold me from my neck all the way to my ankles. And they would put a big row of gauze in my mouth. They'd put gooey stuff on each temple. And they would put a leather band strap around my forehead and things here. And the psychiatrist would reach his hand behind him to a lever that would throw our bodies into grand mal seizures, and sometimes we had to be medically resuscitated. Not every time, but sometimes. There was no physical pain associated with electric shock treatments. But there was something beyond that. Some pain goes beyond physical. It's something that's almost incomprehensible. And he would put his hand up there, and he would look at me and look down in my eyes, and he'd say, "Are you scared?" And the only part of my body I had any control over were my eyelids. And I wouldn't have given him the satisfaction of showing him how I felt. And I just remember looking up at him as his hand would do that, and then I wouldn't know anything for a while. I stayed at the Colorado State Insane Asylum until a week prior to my 18th birthday. For almost 18 months, three times a week, I died. I'm not talking physically. I died. It's been a long, long journey from that person to where I am today. Had I stayed one more week in the state hospital, the state was going to sterilize me so that a person like me could never give birth to another person that would be like me. I was 8 years sober, and I got to give birth to my first and only child. She's nothing like I was. She's nothing like I was. With 8 years of sobriety, God outvoted the state of Colorado. And I got to house a girl child all inside of my body, y'all. And I got to carry her for 9 months. And I got to take that girl child home from the hospital. And I got to hold that baby. And I got to look at that baby. And I got to think, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to hurt it. You know, this is a little bitty baby. She's really cute for a baby. But what am I going to do? She's crying. And I'd ask her to stop, and she keeps crying. And I even said, "Would you please stop?" And she keeps crying. Thank God for the sponsor I had in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I can tell you, I've never called my daughter a dirty name. I've never told my daughter she was stupid. I've never backhanded her. She's never lain in the floor and seen my foot coming upside her head. She's always felt worthy because of the program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I was a good mother, but because of what I was taught through you all. That's why I'm glad I was released by my 18th birthday right before. When I was released, I weighed 300 pounds. I couldn't hold my head erect because of the shock treatments. My chin laid over on my shoulder, and I drooled a lot. And I couldn't speak words. I spoke sounds. I was telling you something. I was asking you, listen to my heart. Listen to my plea. Listen to what I have to say. What you heard was, because that's all that could come out. Eventually, I could hold my head up. Eventually, I learned to speak again. Eventually, I quit walking in that fashion that y'all call the Thorazine shuffle. And that's hard for me to hear that word, because it's like people are saying, "There but for the grace of God go I," which makes me less than, because I walk different. And it was the only way I could get one from one point to another. I never look at another human being and say, "There but for the grace of God go I." Because that one that is the lowest stands the highest at some point in their life. And if I'm doing that and looking at a person and saying, "There but for the grace of God," I'm saying, God likes me better. I'm better. And I'm not. I'm different, but I'm never better. And I'm never really worse. When I left that state hospital and the pounds started going away, my hair was all nappy and gnarly. My teeth were rotting even more out of my head. and my skin was still horrible. I went back to the streets of Denver, Colorado. For the next 10 years of my life, I went from town to town, city to city, state to state, beer joint to beer joint, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. I had no desire to ever get sober. I wound back up in Denver, Colorado in the spring of 1969. I never had a permanent address. People were always real glad to see me go. And I wound back up in Denver, found me a beer joint, found me a bar stool. See, I'm not a club woman. I'm not a tavern drinker. I'm not a housewife drunk. Thank God. I think that has got to be the most lonely, sorrowful existence in the world, to be a female alcoholic that has to hide behind the curtains in her own home and her husband's career, to be at the mercy of one man? Oh, honey, no. When you charge him, they pay you one time, they're gone. When you've got one man that pays you by paying the bills and you're at his mercy, not for me. But I'm sorry, I got off track there a little bit. I guess that's one reason I'm not a marrying type of woman. What was I saying before I so rudely interrupted myself? Oh, I found my bar stool in a beer joint, because I'm a beer joint woman. Let me tell you all about my beer joints, because they are beautiful. They're those beer joints where the stools, the bar stools, have been taped together with that gray tape because all the stuffing's coming out from the plastic covering. There's eggs soaking in purple stuff. Those eggs have been in there probably 20 years. I never saw anybody buy an egg, and I wouldn't have bought one if my life depended on it. It would have bounced. You know, of course you've got the cigarette stains and the music, and I like dark beer joints. I love dark beer joints. I like beer joints where you can go early in the morning, stay all day long, and watch the alcoholic men or the men that have like drinking come in after work. They are so cute. Let me tell you, Al-Anon, that there are any about your husbands. They come in the beer joint after work, and there's that flash of light, and they scope that bar, and they look for her if she's alone. And they don't have to get close enough to smell you yet. But what they do is they scope that bar, and they come down, and they usually leave a bar stool empty between you and them to start. And they are so adorable. All of a sudden, out of this man comes this pathetic, horrible sound, just a guttural, oh. And you think, my God. And you look at him and you say, what's the matter? And they say, oh, lady, work all day for the wife and kids. That's all I do, slave. All I want to do is stop off now and then and have a drink. And when I get home, it's going to be na 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 na. And being a kind woman, I looked at your husband and I would say, if I had a man like you, I'd know how to treat him. Your husbands instantly felt better. They felt handsome. They felt needed. They were going to rescue. And that bar stool in the middle had occupancy. And they said, would you like me to buy you a drink? And in my head, I'm thinking, come on, John. Let's start dealing. And it went that way night after night, day after day. But let me tell you the key behind all of that. Those men never took me home to meet their family. They went back home to you. Most of them didn't even like me. Most of them found me disgusting when they sobered up. You're who they went back to. You know why? You had something to offer that I never had to give to anybody. Cleanliness, loyalty, compassion to a certain degree, and stick-to-itiveness. I'd have killed him. You know, if a man ever came home, crawled up in bed with me and said, honey, I don't know, I don't think I did anything, but I don't remember, I'd have taken a ball bat to him. And then I would have said, well, remember? You don't remember. Hell, you came home that way. You know? I guess it happened while you were out, fool. Because I just woke up and there you were, all bloody and torn. Don't you remember? Alcoholic men don't want me talking to their Al-Anon wives. I stayed drinking in that beer joint, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. One Saturday night, a man and his wife approached me, and he said, "Cricket, my name's Harry, and my wife and I have watched you for some time now, and we think you have a problem drinking." And I thought, and I said, "Excuse me, sir, I don't have a problem drinking." He said, "I'll make a deal with you. If you'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with my wife and I tomorrow night, and we find out you don't have a problem drinking, I'll leave you alone." I'm one of those people who have to take dares. And that sounded like a dare to me. You know, do you realize how insane you are when you allow other people to vicariously live out their own insanity through you? Dare Cricket. She'll do anything. Do it yourself now. You know, but back then, yeah, I had to take the dare. And I felt like he dared me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I could figure what alcoholic meant, but anonymous was a word I'd never heard. Another thing that I didn't know the meaning of. And I thought, okay, I've been incorrigible. I was an adult when I found out that that meant nobody could handle me. I've been a schizophrenic, paranoid reaction, psychotic tendency, sober several years, and my sponsor said, schizophrenic means you're two-faced, and you are. Paranoid means you think people talk behind your back, and they do. And psychotic means you'd rather kill them and yourself, and I still would. You know, I'm not a suicidal junkie. I'm not. And homicidal? Oh, yeah.